I should say the first subject of today's lecture is finite-size scaling. And the references here are to Nigel Goldenfeld's book, and the references that I used. And section 9.11. And Anna has posted this on the wiki. And then there's also an old paper by David Landau. FISREF B13. 1974. And basically, these are just Monte Carlo results, Monte Carlo calculations for the 2D icing model analyzed using finite size scaling. And I'll show you some of his results in a little while. So first of all, I think it's clear, you all know that finite systems do not exhibit phase transitions. It's only in the limit n goes to infinity that the sharp critical behavior that's described by critical exponents can actually occur. So on the other hand, a lot of the techniques that we've used could work equally well for finite systems, where we start off taking our spins and organizing them into block spins and looking at the renormalized coupling constants and flows and things like that. So the basic idea carries over to finite systems. The difference, as I've said, so let's just give this a label. Well, the difference, as I sort of mentioned a number of times, is that the singular part of the free energy depends on the coupling constants, and another parameter so this is for a system with volume L to the D. And you can write down a scaling relation where these k primes are some multiple. Described by an exponent. So everything here is exactly the same as what we're used to, except that we have this extra field, if you like, or extra thing. And this is actually something one can control. I mean, in experimentally or in simulations, one of the things you control is the size of the system. And then the idea is that when L goes to infinity, this thing goes to zero, and you see exactly the behavior that we've discussed many times. So the exponent y sub L in this language is 1. B to the 1 times 1 over L. And the solution for this scaling equation let's just work with a ferromagnetic system. We'll have this form. and we'll write this as C naught over L times divided by T to the YL over YT. So I just put in some microscopic length. If you like, this is part of the definition of what this G plus minus is. But it, for convenience, because then we're going to rewrite this in terms of the correlation length of the infinite system, actually. So C naught here is some microscopic length. And we've already noted that YL is 1, and we've seen several times that 1 over Y sub T is nu, the correlation length exponent. And so basically what these factors are is C naught times T to the minus nu. In other words, the correlation, temperature-dependent correlation function. Is that right? Yeah, 1 over y sub t is nu. Yeah. So basically what we have then is that the singular part of the free energy as a function of T, H, and L to the minus 1 is something like T to the 2 minus alpha, G plus minus, I'm going to call this put this down at the bottom here. Actually putting in what this is, we actually found that this was beta delta. That's not going to be important here. Like that. So again, when L goes to infinity, you get the usual result. On the other hand, you can see that if L is finite, and the correlation length is going to infinity, then this argument is going to infinity instead of zero. Okay, so let's look at the magnetization. And so M is just the derivative of this thing with respect to H for H equals 0. It's going to be something like this, T to the 2 minus alpha minus beta delta. But it doesn't matter. Well, whatever this is turns out to be beta. And we'll look at this below TC. Okay, we're going to first look at this below TC. And
I just assume that expression is valid only for T below TC, and that's what the negative sign is for?
Yeah, we'll come back to what happens. I mean, it's actually has a wider range of the we can extend the range of validity of the scaling function to, for finite systems, well, basically, yeah, for any system for T greater than TC. We'll do that in a minute. But the point is that this is a regime that we think we understand. Below TC, for an infinite system, if this is G minus 0, 0, okay, then the magnetization grows up like T to the beta. Okay, and this thing was like you call it M naught or something like that. Some constant coefficient. Okay. So now the problem is, what happens when you actually have a finite system and you try to analyze what happens here? So as C goes to infinity for finite L, then what happens is that this temperature dependence is going to cancel out, and you're going to get some number that, yeah. What?
How is it possible for finite L to get psi to infinity?
Oh, because we've just defined psi as the infinite system correlation length.
It's
an
infinite system correlation.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way we've defined it. It's that makes everything work, because it's what? Yeah. I mean, what actually happens, yeah, I mean, so what happens is the correlation length gets very long and the whole thing becomes rather rigidly correlated if it's a finite system. Yes?
Sorry, I'm just confused with your notation. The G plus minus in the function, what's the plus minus?
Above TC and below TC.
Okay.
Sorry, that's the notation. So, because they don't have to be the same, I mean, one of the things that comes out of the renormalization group is that the exponents are the same above and below TC, but the actual form of the free energy doesn't have to be exactly the same. And in fact, we'll see in a second a perfect example of this. So, actually, let me just put this up. So for that case, the magnetization will look e t to the beta, and then times some scaling function of L over C. Okay, so where this thing now is going to go to zero, this argument is going to go to zero as C becomes much larger than the system size. And we've chosen the exponent here. So this correlation function has T to the minus nu, which cancels that nu, and then the temperature dependence cancel out. And so this looks like L to the minus beta over nu times this function which I'm just going to write in a slightly different way, but it's essentially the same function. So instead of writing it as a function of L over C, well, it would be L times T to the minus nu. I've redefined the function in such a way that it has linear T and L to the 1 over nu. So it's like this function is the 1 over nu root of this function. Okay. So basically what we have is that if we bring this factor over to the left, versus the argument of this function, which is essentially L to the 1 over nu t. If we can do this for many values of L and t, then we can extract what the behavior of this function is, how it behaves on this, how it depends on this scaling variable. Okay. And that's exactly what you do when you do a Monte Carlo simulation or a numerical simulation. You look at your system at many different temperatures, and you look at it for many different system sizes because you would like to extract the actual exponents or the infinite system size behavior. So maybe you have some questions about this. Let's see, but let's just do this. So reliable. Okay. Ah, I shouldn't have said that. Oh yeah. Okay. So here is some Monte Carlo data. So this is like from medieval times when it was actually hard to do these calculations. On the other hand, the data are actually quite good. I think if you did this with a modern computer, you basically get the same results. I guess the difference would be that you could take n a lot larger, like maybe 10,000 or something like that. So this is for the two-dimensional icing model. And in particular, it's for the two-dimensional icing model on a torus. So it's got periodic boundary conditions. And what you find in that case is that the magnetization doesn't drop sharply to zero like it should for the real infinite system, where it goes has a beta of 1/8. Okay, beta of 1/8 is a very small exponent, which is why the theoretical curve would drop very sharply here. Okay, but the finite systems can't do that, so they just sort of roll off smoothly like this, okay? And so you can take this data and do what I said there. Let's take a look at that. So these are the data for t less than tc. Okay, over some fairly wide range of temperature and also the number is the range that you saw. Okay. And you can see that it falls on this, all the data for t greater than, less than tc fall on this line. And this line corresponds to taking, so this plot corresponds to taking beta equals 1/8 and nu equals 1. Okay. So let me just write that here. Icing model. So basically what this shows is that for this case, m tilde minus of x goes like x to the beta, x to the 1/8. I mean, that's the slope of this line on a log-log plot. Okay. So that's what, that's the information that was gleaned from t below tc. Let me just turn the lights off. Leave the picture up. For t greater than tc, in the infinite size limit, the magnetization is zero. Empirically, when he looked at this data, Landau found that the magnetization as a function of size seemed to be going like 1 over the linear dimension. This is, turns out to be a property. Okay, so at this point, you have to be sensitive to the boundary conditions. You can have open boundary conditions where the spins on the edge have fewer neighbors. Or you can have periodic boundary conditions where you wrap it around. This observation here, I believe, is connected with the periodic boundary conditions, the fact that it goes down nicely like 1 over L. You can read more about the details of that in the paper. So interestingly, if we assume the same scaling form, then m plus, that it's L to the minus beta over nu, m tilde, but now we'll call this m tilde plus of L to the 1 over nu t. And use the observation that this goes like 1 over L. Then you can figure out what m tilde is, which is actually L to the minus nu. Because nu is 1, then m tilde plus of x should go like x to the beta minus nu, which is, okay, so it should go like x to the beta minus nu, x is L to the 1 over nu. So then you get an L to the beta over nu, which cancels this. And what is it? Let's see. Yeah. And then you get an L to the minus 1, which gives you 1 over L. And so this goes like, this is x to the minus 7/8. Okay, that so far so good. Which is that other curve here. Okay. So basically, you could extract the scaling behavior for m above TC for the finite system, as well as for m below TC for the finite system, and that's what you get. Okay. So what's the point? I mean, the point is that you can get a lot of information out of scaling to infinite size, okay? And eventually, if you look at your data hard enough and carefully enough, you can actually get information about the infinite system exponents. And in a sense, when you do numerical calculations, you're always working with finite size. And so if you don't do this analysis, it's like you're throwing away a lot of information. Okay, so you can, it's actually quite amazing what, you know, significant results you can get out of relatively small sizes when you vary the size.
So, since we're looking at finite systems to see how infinitely sized systems behave, because
right.
Finite systems are all we have. Since the world is made up of finite size systems, why are we?
Is that what you think?
Much of the world is.
Yeah. So why is it that we ever see?
Well, why are we so interested in using finite systems as something flawed, not quite what we want, in order to gain information about the infinitely sized systems? If the world we're in contains so many finitely sized systems, why not focus on those? As in, that could be our goal rather than a subpar tool.
Okay, so this is a little bit of a philosophical question. So I'll answer it in that vein. So to some extent, the fact that people focused in on critical behavior in infinite systems was because of the dramatic effects that were observed in macroscopic systems. And it's true that the macroscopic systems, like you and me, are finite. Nevertheless, if you understand what the underlying microscopic scale is, then things like L turn out to be very large numbers. Okay, so it's and they're sufficiently large so that the range in which the behavior deviates from infinite system size behavior is actually experimentally inaccessible, except if we artificially make systems which are really finite on the microscopic scale. So mesoscopic systems, where your dimension might be 1,000 or 100 or even less, you can make those these days, and you can study them. And one wants to understand them, because if nothing else, that's what all of our devices are made out of, these little very, very finite elements. And so, yeah, you're right. But on the other hand, it's also true that to some extent, the theoretical problem of finite systems is easier than the infinite size limit. And so it took a lot of work for people to sort out what happens in the limit as n goes to infinity, or l goes to infinity. And then once they understood that, they could sort of back off and say, OK, and then this is how you get from here to there, or from there to here. So yeah, it's all important. There's no question about it. OK, so the next subject that I'd like to talk about today is crossover phenomena. And again, I'm basing this on a discussion by Nigel. This is section 9.9 is a nice discussion of crossover phenomena, which I've cribbed from heavily. Okay? And so what do we mean by crossover phenomena? The simplest example of crossover phenomena is what happens in the ferromagnet if you cool it down in a small magnetic field. And the point is that if the field that you're cooling it down in is really small, then you can lower the temperature and you don't even notice that field. The spins don't even notice that field. But at a certain point, when the correlation length starts to get very long, then all of a sudden that small field is acting on a large correlated block of spins. And things change. The field, because remember, the field is a relevant relevant variable. So as we've seen many times, the singular part of the free energy as a function of T and H is this T to the 2 minus alpha times some function plus minus of H over T. This time we'll call it delta. That's the other name for it. Where delta, well, actually, is YH over YT is actually that combination of exponents. And and F plus or minus of 0 is some non-zero number, which can be different for plus or for minus. It's not necessarily the same number. So this tells you what happens when H is 0, or when T is large, either one. So the question is, what happens for large H over T to the delta? So in that case, so to get the magnetization, you differentiate once with respect to H, bring out this factor of T to the minus delta. And this is multiplying F prime . This goes like this is for this is for large that. And why do we know that? Because we know that when T goes to 0, or when you go to, at the critical temperature, you know the field dependence of the magnetization Did I do this right? Yes, I did. So then this is equal to, that's beta. This thing here goes to 1. This thing here is just 1 because of the relations among the exponents. So working backwards, that tells you how the free energy scales with its argument. It's just some power law. But the perhaps it's most important is this. So when you start out at high temperatures, this thing's very small. As you cool down, you reach this point, and you cross over to high field behavior. Okay. So the crossover and delta here, which is y sub h over y sub t, is the so-called crossover exponent. It basically tells you how steeply this curve goes up. Yeah, Nicole.
We've been talking about the ferromagnets and how behavior changes magnetic field and temperature. How does crossover behavior differ from phase transition?
Yeah, so if H is truly zero, okay, or T is truly zero, but let's say if H is truly zero, then you have a phase transition. If H is not zero, then you have crossover. That's what this is telling you. And it's also telling you that it's not like H doesn't have to necessarily be very big. It's all a question of how close you can get to TC before you see that crossover behavior. Now you know, for instance, that to actually extract the exponents, like beta, for instance, you need to get very close to TC and actually measure the magnetization over a few decades of T minus TC over TC. But if there happens to be some small magnetic field, for instance, the Earth's field, which is on the order of a half a Gauss. It's a medieval unit. It's 0.5 times 10 to the minus 4th Tesla. Okay. So if you happen to be, and then you say, okay, well, what's the scale for a magnet? Okay, so if it's iron or nickel, the internal field I think it's on the order of a tenth of a Tesla. I didn't bother to look it up. It's hundreds to maybe a couple thousand or low thousand Gauss. I think it's in the hundreds, actually. Maybe smaller than that. So you can see that whatever goes on inside of a good ferromagnet is at a scale which corresponds to some significant field. That's why magnets are useful, because they generate large B fields spontaneously. And if your problem is the Earth's field, it's down a few orders of magnitude from the scale that you associate with the ferromagnet. But nevertheless, if you're trying to get really close to TC, that could cause you a problem. So if you want to do an experiment on measuring the critical exponents, you put a lot of magnetic shielding around your sample so that the Earth's field isn't. And if that doesn't work, you cancel it out. You try to cancel out any field with some little coils that basically zero the field out, so that you can get very, very close to TC without having the field just flip everything for you.
When you were talking about the middle port,
right,
on the right hand side, you were mentioning that H is a relevance field?
Yes, it is.
Yes, which is a property of the group flow?
Yeah.
But I was wondering, how does the properties of group flow relate to this? How does it come into play? What were you thinking?
Actually, I think the figure that I find more useful is just the phase diagram. If you look at the H T phase diagram now, it's the fact that anywhere up here, M is greater than zero, and anywhere down here, M is less than zero. And so it's only along this line that you see the critical behavior. And so in that sense, that's sort of what you mean by relevant. I mean, that's exactly what you mean by relevant, that putting on a small positive or a small negative field will really change the behavior out here around the critical point. When you get lower down, it doesn't change it so much, because the spontaneous magnetization, and even in zero field, the magnetization would grow up. Okay, but particularly out here, small positive or negative fields change everything. And that's what relevant means. Okay. In the RG flow, you have this unstable fixed point, because when you're at the fixed point, for the relevant fields, the flow is away. It's unstable in that sense. Just like this is unstable, if you're a little bit up here, you get magnetization up, a little bit down here, you get it down. So I mean, there's no question it's all connected together. Good. OK, so I want to talk about one other crossover. There'll be two in a sense, but I won't talk. I'll talk about the other one, which is disorder on Friday. But there's crossover due to anisotropy. And so here, now let's finally talk about a model which is not an Ising model. Let's talk about the so-called Heisenberg model. Which is another spin model, for which minus beta h is some constant, positive constant, sum over nearest neighbor spins. And the spins are vector spins. Well, the direction of HI is on the unit sphere. So it's any direction in three-dimensional space. And this model has rotational isotropy. And that's a very nice property that gives rise to all kinds of behavior like Goldstone modes, for example. Or spin waves, which are the Goldstone modes for the system. Come right down to zero energy. However, most spins are sitting inside of crystals, and crystals are not necessarily, well, they're not actually isotropic, although they can make a good approximation to it as far as these spins are concerned. For instance, in cubic crystals, that might be all you need to get something of this form. So the question is, what does anisotropy look like? Well, there's different kinds of anisotropy, probably as many as you can imagine. But in particular, you can have single ion anisotropy. So in that case, you have your Heisenberg term, and then you have another term, say, Siz squared. So that's single ion because this is the property of one spin. And so if G is positive, and this, then the spins would prefer to point along plus or minus Z. And so that sort of breaks the symmetry. Another kind that you can have is nearest neighbor exchange anisotropy. Well, or any neighbor for that matter. And so there, your Hamiltonian looks like this, minus beta h, k. You've got your Heisenberg piece. Plus, for instance, you could have something like this, KZZ. Again, sum over nearest neighbors. And there's many ways to write this. But you can see what happens. It's to the first approximation, the spins want to be parallel, but the second term says that they're a little bit happier being parallel if they're both aligned along Z. Okay, so that kind of, and that's, this is commonplace also in materials. It results, both of these things are consequences of the spin orbit coupling, and that can enter into the, of course, ferromagnetism in ubiquitously results from what's called exchange, the properties of fermions, this anti-symmetric wave functions and so forth. But the exchange can also have some anisotropy if you include the effects of higher order interactions like spin orbit. So actually there's an interesting difference which I just mentioned. People are often interested in, people are interested in quantum spins, and the most extreme quantum spin is the spin half, okay? And if you say, if you have a system that has spin half ions, this term here doesn't give you anisotropy, because SZ squared is just a quarter. And so it doesn't do anything in the extreme quantum limit. And so then you might say, well, how can I have anisotropy for spin half systems on a lattice? And the answer is this way. Actually, there's another term. There's another kind of anisotropy, which is called Zaleshinsky-Moraya interaction, which has S cross S and some vector defining a direction for the anisotropy. But they all come about from spin orbit coupling. Nicole?
Did you say the first term, if we're describing the ferromagnet, encodes the desire of the nearest neighbors to align?
Parallel, but in any direction. For these Heisenberg spins, they want to be parallel, but they don't care which direction they're parallel in. Unlike the icing guys who can just be up or down. So the question is, what does the phase diagram look like for such a system? And for simplicity, we'll just look at the single ion case. It's the same. And so basically what you've got here is you've got icing up here, you've got XY down here. If G is negative, then the spins want to be parallel in the plane perpendicular to Z. But it doesn't matter where they're oriented in that plane. So those spins want to go into a planar state, which is exactly the model that you've been looking at in your tutorial. But you've been looking at the two-dimensional XY model, which has its own pathologies. But nevertheless, the symmetry of those spins is that they want to lie in a plane. Out here, on both sides, you have disorder at high temperatures for sure. And right on this line, you have Heisenberg. So the point is that if you study this system, you're coming down from high temperatures, and you don't notice, if the anisotropy is small, you don't notice it. If the anisotropy is zero, you will have a phase transition at this point, which I guess we could call T Heisenberg, into a ferromagnetic state where the spins can pick out one direction in which to point. Okay? And so that will be a phase transition, which is characteristic of the isotropic Heisenberg model, and there will be critical exponents associated with that, which are Heisenberg exponents in whatever dimension you're in, say three. Okay, and actually those, I think, those come from the three-component model that we talked about. Okay. So if it's exactly zero, so it's disordered out here. Now, on the other hand, if there's a little bit of icing like anisotropy, then depending on how little it is, at some point you're going to cross over into icing. Also, there's a whole line of phase transitions here, which might look something like this. As you crank up G, you just make it more favorable to go into that aligned state. And similarly down here, so this is all disordered. And so now you can see that your free energy.
John?
Yep. I'll get 1 minute. Okay. Yeah, so I can't quite finish this argument. So actually, maybe I'll do it next time then, because there's just a little bit of scaling here. But however, the point is that this G is clearly strongly relevant. Just like the magnetic field is strongly relevant for the icing model. Okay, so I have to run, unfortunately. So we'll finish this up if the start of the lecture tomorrow.